In Search of Lost Lives, Michael Gardner with us, a very unique memoir in which he recovers over 70 past lives and depicts spiritual experiences that ultimately prepared him to follow a path of soul liberation. And we're going to talk with him about that and take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me tell you a little bit about Michael Goddard, the researcher and author. He started actively searching for the truth about death and how to attain everlasting bliss at the age of 11 years old. And throughout his life, he studied the writings of saints and mystics as well. His book is called In Search of Lost Lives. Michael, at 11 years old, what started you on that mission?
Well, I had a little religious service, and it struck me that what I needed was something that was alive, that could really answer my needs. My whole life seemed to change, George, once we moved to California. When I was 10, we moved to Marin County. And I started trying to contact higher beings through automatic writing. I started self-hypnosis. And right after I turned 11, we had a religious service, and I thought, this is not going to be my path. I need to search. And I started to confront death. Since I'd been five, I'd had tropical fish. So I'd seen many die that I had to flush down the toilet, unfortunately.
Yeah, we've all had to do that as kids.
Yeah, so that was very sad. So I really confronted the fact that I was going to die, and I was just seized with the absolute feeling that I had to do something about it, that I could achieve immortality, that I had to devote my life to searching for that.
Is this what you call your spiritual evolution now?
That was part of it. I mean, I came in, you know, primed to continue searching. I had been searching in earnest, George, for my last three lives, starting when I was an architect in post-American Revolution Baltimore, and then through my next two lives in England. And my most recent life, I was a seeker, really, for most of my life, reading book after book that I got from Foyle's bookstore. But I never found what I was looking for. But my soul had been touched because two lives before that, I was a British banker, and I had an assignment overseas. I shipped out to India during the Raj. And I was just drawn the first year to Agra, and I took one of the early trains there from Bombay, and I thought ostensibly I was going to see the Taj Mahal and the Agra Fort, but while I was in journey in the train, I began to think, wait a minute, I bet there could be a Swami in Agra. I wonder if there is. So my English host, who was putting me up, he was very polite. As soon as there was an opening in the conversation, I said, do you by any chance know of a Swami? And he didn't think so. Then it came to him that he had an employee who followed one. Well, they arranged an interview for me that afternoon, and I went to meet this saint who was unlike any other human being I'd ever encountered.
Could you tell that the minute you met him?
It took a while. You know, this lifetime, when I've met perfect saints, I knew immediately because I was primed. But as we got in the conversation, as I looked into his eyes, I knew this was a human being entirely different from other human beings. It was just extraordinary. So I had an interview with him for about an hour and a quarter with a translator sitting in his courtyard, and I asked question after question. Before I had shipped out to Bombay, I had joined the Metaphysical Society, which you may have heard of in London.
Yeah.
And I would study their papers, and I'd get them shipped to me. So I was in full search mode. But I was kind of primed for looking for a master because when I was in Baltimore, I discovered the Compte de Saint Germain, who you probably have heard of. And I was fascinated by a master who could kind of defy time and realize all his human potential. So that life was very much about finding a master. So, you know, the searching goes on from life to life, if that's what you're primed to do. And it really kind of, you know, I could write a book kind of going back and back to when it started. But, you know, when I lived in Tibet 12 years back, I was in the government. I was a highly placed official. I first came across what I would call evolved humans in my Buddhist temples. And one in particular greatly impressed me. I thought, here is a human who has attained higher consciousness, who has evolved. So that really kind of set the ball rolling, that life in Tibet.
How did you know you had so many past lives, Michael?
Well, I figured I'd had a lot, but, you know, it all sort of started to come together in 2013, in March. And pieces of the lives started to come through, and actually a channel to my higher consciousness opened up, basically, or I knew how to access my higher consciousness. I had been primed mainly because I've been meditating 2.5 hours daily since I was 21, and meditating with the sound current, which is really kind of pure consciousness. But since the early 90s, George, I had been literally practicing expanding my sense of knowing, my intuition, doing different means. And that became of utmost importance when my intestine died in 2012. And I almost very closely died myself. So I got into a situation where I was having these horrific bowel obstructions, and I had to be careful to eat the exact food I needed to eat and not a spoonful more. So I literally had to intuit every single bite I had to eat. So I was actively intuiting all day long. So that really helped to develop my intuition. But I think we all have this power innate within us. It's just a question of developing it.
Did you undergo hypnotherapy?
No, never did. Well, I mean, I actually started doing self-hypnosis right after we arrived in Marin County when I was 10.
But not with a hypnotherapist.
I tried it with a few hypnotherapists, but they couldn't hypnotize me. They gave up. I guess I had too strong a willpower. So I've never had anything like hypnotic regression. I did go to a few psychics in my 20s and 30s, and they would mention past lives. And what I found was really interesting when I started to recover them, I thought, well, I wonder about this past life that they talked about. I wonder if this was true. And honestly, George, not one past life I was told about by a psychic was true. So
that's interesting.
Yeah, which is interesting.
Maybe the wrong psychic, Michael.
Yes. Well, the thing is, we're all psychic to a degree. We all have higher consciousness.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that.
It's just really a question of your priorities and where you're putting your attention.
What, based on your experience, have you concluded what the soul might be?
Absolutely. The soul is simply a spark of the divine, the supreme being. The soul is just, you know, you can call it a drop, a spark, an element of pure consciousness. We all have souls. Now, the situation is that the soul is basically covered by the mind. Think of a light bulb with brilliant, brilliant light, and then get 1,000 yards of gauze and start wrapping the gauze around the light bulb. Well, pretty soon it's going to mask all the light of the light bulb. So to exist in this plane, we had to take on the association of the mind to function. So obviously we all have minds. So soul and mind are knotted together. That's kind of a basic principle.
Is there, based on your experience, a hell?
Oh, absolutely.
Because some people don't think there is.
Well, there is hell. There are hells. I think for me, in often case, there were what I would call, George, bespoke hells. The first life I recovered from another planet was when I was a ruler of a country, a good-sized country, and I was appointed by the previous ruler. And it was a pretty peaceful planet, but there were a few wars that started around the planet, and I was getting kind of anxious that a more powerful country could invade us. So I started a war, and because of that, over 260,000 men, women, and children died.
Oh, jeez.
And when I...
Kind of backfired, didn't it?
Yeah, when I discovered that, I felt more awful than you can describe.
I bet.
I mean, I just wanted to crawl into a ball.
You were actually a leader with a conscience, huh?
Well, yeah, but I also had quite an enormous ego, you know.
Now, was that on this planet or someplace else?
This was the second planet on which I dwelt, which is called Vizine.
Vizine.
That's not the exact name, but it's the closest approximation in English. So I actually had my most human lives on the planet Vizine.
Was it in our galaxy?
Oh, no. And I didn't actually haven't tried to find a galaxy. It was somewhere completely different. But I was a human, and I can later get into what I how I define a human. But getting back to hell, well, you know, I created this humongous amount of karma. So I went to a hell. I was there alone for a seeming eternity and underwent indescribable suffering. But, you know, hell's end, eventually I came back. And from then on, I had an aversion to ruling over people. And one thing that I think is interesting is that I took a life, you know, not that long ago, when I was this was a pre-Christian life, and I was born into a family that owned a settlement. You know, we owned a settlement of 50 people, and we'd owned it for several generations. And I was the firstborn, and I was meant to take over the settlement.
Well, you mean like a little community?
Yeah, like a little community. I mean, we basically owned all the land. We owned the structures. We basically owned the people. But we ruled it, you know, pretty fairly. But, you know, these were like a little bit like glorified slaves.
And they worked for you, I guess.
Yeah, they worked for us. So I had a total aversion to the idea, because I had gone through that reformation of my character, to ruling over these people. And one day I brought it up to my parents and younger brother, and they just, they couldn't process what I was telling them.
Did they think there was something wrong with you?
Absolutely. They thought, well, this is unthinkable and unacceptable, and they dismissed the idea. Well, I nursed the idea, and I knew I had to get away. I knew I couldn't handle it. So finally, one morning, just at the break of dawn, I left my good horse with them, and I set off on foot and got as far as away as I could. And this is in the chapter of the section called Where Confidence Took Me. I needed an injection of confidence to do this. And actually, I worked on confidence between lives before this pre-Christian life with a spiritual teacher. And I kept going and going until I reached the country that is now Hungary, and I became a teacher. I had been inspired by a grandfather who was a teacher. So that is a sanskara, which is an impression from a past life. I had a complete aversion to ruling over people, and I did everything I could to get out of it. Now, this first life I recovered on another planet is what I call a notable life. And I had 13 notable lives, 5 on the second planet. And a notable life is sort of a life that's larger than life. It's just writ large, and it has a great role in building who you are. It's like one of the main building blocks of your foundation. So for years, I mean, before I became a writer and before I became a tax accountant, you know, I wanted to go in the diplomatic service. I was an exchange student twice. I've always had a fascination with foreign countries. And still, when I'm reading about foreign relations, I am seeing myself what I would do as a benevolent ruler, a benevolent, all-knowing autocrat, how I would change things in the world. So this is a sanskara, an impression that carries over from the time when I was a ruler. Now, if someone were to offer me a little kingdom somewhere, no matter if it was a fabulous island in the South Seas, I would say, forget it. I'm not taking it.
You wouldn't take it.
But
not even if it was Monaco, right?
Well, gosh, you know, I almost took a job in Monaco. Tell you the truth, it sounded very appealing, but doing international tax work, but I didn't actually. But no, I would turn it down. But still, I have that powerful sanskara from imagining myself as a ruler and how I would do things and how I'd create a true meritocracy where everybody could develop their full potential. But no, it's never going to happen because I had it wiped out of me in that hell.
Now, back to the soul one more time.
Sure.
Do you believe that if somebody's evil, they're going to be punished when they die?
Well, you know, they've accumulated Well, you know, it's a little hard to generalize because their evil actions may have been part of a karma they came in with, you know, and they may be paying back somebody who is evil to them. But if they're creating new karmas, they're definitely going to have to pay for it. Every single action, deed, speech, thought is accounted for. And I write about what I call the negative power, which we call Kal, which means time and death. And I call him, one of the names I call him is the constant accountant. Everything you're doing is being constantly accounted for. And basically,
And recorded,
it's
right?
being recorded, yes. And you're building up constantly this reserve of debts, of karmas. Karma just means action. So if you go and kill 10 people, you've got to pay for it. I mean, we wonder, you know, why do bad things happen to good people? Well, there's a reason. And you can't really generalize because every situation is going to have its individual story. But, you know, one thing that happened to me, well, for years, whenever I'd see a movie, George, that dealt with an orphan, I would just automatically start crying.
An orphan?
An orphan. I mean, when I watched Cider House Rules, I would just keep crying. I mean, I had this total soft spot in my heart for orphans. Well, as it turns out, the fourth life before this life, I was an orphan in Denmark. My mother gave up on me and gave me away. She left me on the doorstep of an orphanage in the winter, Denmark. Luckily, they opened the door and found me. So I was brought up in this cold, bare place without any love in this orphanage. And luckily, I got away when I was 15 and I joined an acting troupe. I call that life, a lot of the lives just automatically had names. And this life, George, is called the love hungry life. And I did everything I could to fill this hole of needing love.
Were you able to?
Oh, well, I became an actor. I mean, I went from acting troupe to finally having my own.
But that did that fill the hole, though, the gap?
It filled it to an extent. But, you know, actually, I feel we all have this hole, this longing, that's longing to be filled. And that longing is actually the soul's longing to return to its source. The soul just has one desire, and that's for complete, all-encompassing love, which it can really only experience when it's reunited with the love source, with God, with the, you know, ocean of bliss.
Which I guess is the quest, right?
That is the quest. And most people, because of their minds, they get misdirected. They think they're going to fill that hole by winning the lottery. Once they get $1 million, everything will be perfect. They'll get a beautiful home. People will look up to them. Well, who knows what problems will happen? You know, their best friend or their father may run off with most of their money or cheat them.
Or you could be very unhappy.
Exactly. I mean, one of the most, you know, some of the most anxious people in the world are the richest people because they're worried about how are they going to hang on to all their money. And they have all this stuff going on. I've had so many accountant friends who've had employees who've finally let go of them because of just all the issues that came up, and they were just happier being alone. But we all have this longing that comes to us at special times. And to me, it's sort of God nudging us to look within. And it's nudging us to really be aware and get on with our
We're
search.
going to take a break in just a moment here and come back with Michael Goddard. His website is his last name, all linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. I'll spell it GODDART.com. GODDART.com. We're talking about his work in search of lost lives. He also apparently had one of the lives on Atlantis. We'll talk with him about that too when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Michael Goddard with us. His book is called In Search of Lost Lives. Website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Michael, where can people get your book?
Well, they can get it at Amazon or Barnes and Noble. If they want to learn much more about it, they're happy to go to my website, goddard.com. And there I list 29 things that the book does, which really gives a good overview. I've got excerpts and blurbs that support the book. So it's it can be easily ordered.
One of your many lives was on Atlantis, apparently. This fascinates me. Tell me about this continent, this island, and what it looked like, what kind of technology they had there, and what happened.
Well, I actually had, of all my lives on Earth, which was actually the smallest number of the three planets, the greatest number of lives were on Atlantis, and it goes through quite a long period. The first lives I actually recovered were three lives when I was a slave, and that goes back to 133,211 before the Common Era. And it goes as recently as 17,288 before the Common Era. But one of my favorite lives that was very meaningful for me, George, was when I was a seer in Atlantis. And one of the reasons is that I was the third born, and my older brother and sister, I actually know in this life. With the brother, that was the second of our five lives, and later we had a very, very close relationship in Denmark. And also the mother, I know quite well this lifetime. I have no problem accessing that kind of information. But in any case, in that life, when I was the age of 10, I knew I'd wanted to be a seer. My father was sort of a light worker. He helped healing people with different colored lights. But when I was 20, I struck out on my own, and I, with his help, I bought a little building and had a table built, and I would see clients, and I'd give them readings, tell them about relationships, people were coming into their lives, just really what they needed to know to help them. It was sort of a little bit like a life coach, but I was a seer. I was able to see into the future a little bit. So that was one of my favorite lives.
What happened to Atlantis?
Well, you know, I don't think I was living when it finally disappeared, but many of the lives I recovered, I was on what I call Poseidonis. It was after several of the huge, huge cataclysms that made it disappear. So it was really just sort of a very, very large island, you know, 20, 30,000 years before the Common Era. So I wasn't there at the time it went down, but this is my understanding that it did go down finally. And there were all kinds of societies there. I mean, some of them were very spiritual. Some of them were very rough. Those lives as a slave, I actually had 10 lives as a slave in Atlantis, and I write about three of them. And I also write about a life as a slave when I was in Bosnia. But just to give an example, because I think a lot of people have some scars that come through, and if they were just to pause and give them, you know, be aware of them, they could get in touch with their past lives. When the movie 12 Years a Slave came out, I saw the preview, and I was very impressed, and I thought, well, this is a really important film. I'm going to need to see that. So that was that. I wasn't looking forward to it because I'm really sensitive. But anyway, I just happened to be watching a show on TV, and the preview came on again, and instantly I was thrown back into a life as a slave. It was really one of the hardest when I was taken at the age of 21, when I was just striking out on my own. I'd had a wonderful relationship with my single mother. So that was the first indication that I'd had lives as slaves, and then I went on to write about three of those lives. But I also had one of my favorite lives was when I lived in a very wealthy family and I became a soapstone connoisseur. It sounds kind of fey and ridiculous, but I would go on expeditions with a horse and my foreman and look for soapstones. But the point is, in that life, I had like a breakthrough spiritual experience, and I started to get really interested in philosophy. So I went to the Capitol, and I bought all the scrolls I could that might have anything to do with metaphysics and life, and I became a self-taught philosopher, actually.
Really?
Yeah, and that actually fed into my life way, way later in Greece, about 216 after the Common Era, when I was a philosopher, and I attended schools in Corinth. And that actually was, I was set up to be a philosopher partly because that actually was the most wealthy of my recent lives. We had vast holdings. It was a noble family, but I lost my parents at a very young age. They died of a severe influenza epidemic. So my main relationship that life was my father's younger brother, my uncle. But he had great aspirations for our family. His wife couldn't have children. She kept miscarrying. So I was it. You know, I was carrying on the family name. Although there was an issue with that because I was what I would call homophile. I wasn't attracted to women. I was attracted to men. So he tried to set me up with women, but I had no interest. But what I did have an interest in was philosophy. And this also relates to a life, just a few lives before that, when I was a teacher on Santorini and taught young men and boys. And I developed a great love for philosophy. And I developed the desire to be a philosopher. So this life when I was a philosopher in ancient Greece was really a culmination of different desires and that had formed into karmas. Desire is sort of the warp and woof in a great deal of existence. You know, if you desire something strong enough, it's going to form into a karma and it's going to come to pass somehow. It's going to have to be satisfied.
We have Dr. Bruce Goldberg, one of our regular guests, Michael, who comes on and talks about past lives and future lives.
Mm-hmm.
Has that ever happened to you, a future life that you can remember what you will be?
Well, no, because actually I have the firm conviction or feeling that this is my last life.
This is it?
In the physical, yes. You know, my spiritual evolution started as a human over 3,000 lives ago. When I was on my first planet, I was a mother with 6 children, and I had a spiritual experience. I'd be happy to relate that. And that was 3,014 lives before. For some reason, I can...
How many have you had?
Lives were. What?
How many have you had?
4,137.
Lives?
Human lives.
Wow!
I've had millions of all kinds of lives. I mean...
I thought we had maybe a dozen.
Oh, no. Most people, I mean, there may be some people who are starting out as humans, and they may be very animal-like, or they may have kind of gotten, they may have been angels and taken a human form. I mean, everybody's story is individual.
Well, the fact that you're not going to come back again as a human, does that mean you've met this level of perfection that we call heaven?
Well, it means that I've met what I call a perfect living master who's initiated me into the practice of the sound current or Shabad. So my karmic account is no longer held by the negative power. He has taken over my entire karmic account. So basically, I've
You've won. Graduated.
Yeah, I've won the greatest lottery you could win. So the karmas are being paid off, but I cannot leave the physical plane. Well, I mean, I'll leave the physical plane when I die, but I can't leave the higher mental planes until all that karma is paid off and extinguished.
Now, what does that mean?
Well, that means it's burned off, you know, by a combination of meditation on the sound current, by the grace of the teacher, you know, and forgiveness. But no soul can leave the physical, astral, causal planes, that's what we can call them in English, until they are devoid of karma. And that's what keeps souls and minds locked in the creation. They have these karmic debts. So you're going to keep coming back and coming back. And after each life, your actions are weighed. If your bad actions outweigh your good actions, well, there's a good possibility you'll come back as an animal. In my book, In Search of Lost Lives, I give quite a variance of actions in which I did hurtful things that made me come back as an animal. And some of them people might think were pretty mild or minor, like the way I treated a daughter or the way I was mean to a coworker. But it was enough to tip the balance, George, and I did not come back as a human.
But it comes back to you in waves if you are a bad person, doesn't it?
What, I'm sorry? What did you
The karma really comes back to you in many ways if you were a bad person.
Oh yeah, the karma will. And the thing is, we've had so many actions that they can't be paid off in your next life. People have monumental reserves of karma. So for each new life, it's formed from that reserve of karma, and you're working out desires. I mean, the negative power just wants one thing: to keep all these souls and minds in his domain. He's what I call the ultimate reality show producer. He doesn't want anybody to escape. And, you know, in my teachings, this is an actual being. So people think, oh, it'd be wonderful to come back or to go to heaven. The point is, you don't know what horrible things you've done in past lives. And, you know, the time may come up where you've got to pay that off. And people, listen, my lives on my first two planets were kind of like cakewalks compared to Earth. The Earth is not an easy place to be alive in. I mean, look at all the suffering. So I just encourage people to kind of be aware of what you want to do with your life. I mean, do you want to keep coming back, or do you want to transcend physicality and live in unalloyed love and bliss? Most people are really prisoners of their desires. You know, the best thing they could do would be go on a cruise, win $1 million, you name it. But, you know, let your imagination soar.
Sure.
Anything is possible.
We're going to take calls with Michael Goddard. We'll do that next hour as well. Charles in Elgin, Texas, to get us started here. Charles, go ahead.
Yeah, Michael.
Hi,
dude. Thank you for accepting my call. I appreciate it. My question is sort of, how do you know when you're not being sort of delusional? I mean, there's so many pitfalls. It seems to me, even if you've got, you know, thousands and then even millions of, I guess, of past existences and lives and things, how in the heck do you sort of distinguish them? Or how do you, it's kind of like, you know, there's possibility you could just be a really good novelist and able to create all kinds of new characters and everything.
Right. So it's the question, how does one know you're not being delusional? Or
yeah, I would guess so.
Or how do people know I haven't just made this up? Well, to answer the second question first, you know, I am a writer, and if I was writing a book about my past lives, I sure wouldn't have put in so many. I would have had some pretty glamorous lives, like a prince. I would have been a courtesan with all kinds of powerful men.
Well, you were a leader of a country.
I sure was, but that's something
that didn't work out well.
It did not work out well, but I had a ball during the life, but then I paid the price. But, you know, I've been developing my sense of knowing, my intuition, most of my life. I also did preparatory work between lives. Before I came into this life, I knew I would be accessing my spiritual lives, and I did this special preparation with a spiritual teacher who helped me to go across time quite easily to access what I needed to. But in terms of knowing what's true, it's just you need to keep developing your inner sense of knowing. We all have that intuition and our higher consciousness. It's constantly developing your sense of knowing and knowing what's right, listening to that. And there are different ways you can develop that, actually. So did that answer his questions? I hope so.
You did well, Michael. You did well. And we'll do the same next hour as well. Has any of this ever scared you?
No. In fact, it was just such a relief because I've had all these weird idiosyncrasies. I mean, when I was 7, I started making floor plans and elevations of houses. I couldn't stop. I just loved it. You know, I thought for a while I was going to be an architect. In fact, I had an interview once we moved to California when I was 11. I had just turned 11 with the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation, and they offered me a job looking at my plans. Well, one of the things I found out soon after I began to access my past lives was this architect life when I was in Baltimore. And I just did commercial architecture, and I was constantly struggling to make enough money to feed my family with 4 children. Well, I nursed the desire to do residential architecture. I never got to. So when I was a boy, I got to do residential architecture. I paid off that desire. And then I decided this was not my path. My path was searching for immortality, true immortality, or if I couldn't find it, figurative, like I tried being an actor for a while. And that relates to four lives back when I was an actor. I was acting from the age of 7. It was just a natural thing. I was writing plays that were takeoffs on Shakespeare. These were all sanskaras, impressions from these recent past lives. So to me, I think, you know, people are very much into their genealogy and their blood and their ancestry. I think what's really more telling, George, what really kind of defines us as unique individuals is who we've been in our past lives. I think if people could discover their past lives, it would explain a lot about them.
Well, it would, because I do think they carry it over a lot into their other lives. Why can't they remember, though? Why do they have to either go under hypnosis or, in your case, the way you meditated to find out?
Well, this being that, you know, rules over the three realms has several booms, one of which, for all intents and purposes, most people can't remember their past lives.
They can't.
No, because otherwise they would know all the suffering they'd gone through and they'd want to get out.
So it's like a block?
It's the block.
All right, we're going to come back and take more phone calls with you, Michael, next on Coast to Coast AM.